This is an Enterprise Time Security podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here at Black Hat, and I'm talking with Alex and Samir from Spirent Communications.
I'm Samir Dukshat. I'm the VP for our security consulting practice at Spirent called Security Labs.
Alexander Garkovienko. I'm extension of Security Labs in the UK and Europe. I'm managing consultant and I'm responsible for operations in the UK.
One of the big challenges we have with DevSecOps is making sense of how we bring two worlds together. Security like to control, Dev and Ops now just see this as something they do. How do we get everybody on the same page?
The bigger question to ask here is, how do we do it without friction? Because again, no one likes writing a bad code. The bigger issue is developers previously were really not brought up to speed in terms of writing a secure code. There was a lack of training. There was lack of security knowledge per se. And anytime they are writing the code and they're sending it back to security team, which was keeping all the security tools in their arsenal, running these fancy tools and then saying, hey, there is a problem. Now with the DevSecOps, what this is forcing us is to have that basic security knowledge and the feedback transmitted back to the development team.
How do we get security to understand sprints? Because the whole power of DevOps is short, sharp iterations where we find the errors, we fix them, but we also take a risk assessment. Can we allow that piece of technical debt to roll over to the next iteration? Security tends to be very black and white. It needs to change, does it not?
First and foremost thing that should happen is, how do we make this process frictionless? Removing of that friction comes from having an automation. You have your development tools and your build checking systems like Jenkins and others be integrated with your code scanners. So as you're checking in code overnight before you go home, you check in your code, by the time you come tomorrow morning, you already have the feedback from the scanner. So that by itself reduces that friction, because now you're not really dependent on a third party to take an action. In our case was security operations team to run an assessment on their schedule and then write a report and provide that report. By automation or by better tooling and integration, you could actually reduce that friction. Now when we talk about the control, this constant battle between DevOps wants to get the code out fast because they are measured on productivity, whereas security operation team is measured on security effectiveness. So how do we marry those two together so that they are running towards the common objective? One of the things that I always say is, without education, you cannot achieve that. Education is by replaying some of the attacks or some of the negative effects that could happen from bad written code or poorly written code. These comes from examples of hacks that have already happened in the industry, or extra education that you could provide to developers by showing them the consequences of it. Now that you have done that, you have created a system where at least, and you have to do it over and over, it doesn't get solved in a day. I hear something and then I only get 20% of it. So you have to have this constant loop of training your development so that they also have the same common objective as security professionals, which is we have to get a secure code out.
You talked there about the overnight cycle. When we've been doing that now for 10, 15 years, we have a build overnight, we sit down in the morning and we look at what went wrong. With orchestration and with automation, can we not speed that up? Can we not say that as soon as you check in your piece of code, you do a build? Because if I wait till the morning, I have all these errors, but actually a lot of them may be false errors. They only failed because one piece of code further up the tree failed. But it can take us an hour to work that out. If when you check your code in, a build is run just for you, very quickly you know where your code fails. It plays very much into that automation you were talking about.
I'm not really saying that there is a limit to automation. So whatever makes sense in terms of getting that feedback quickly to the developer is probably the right mechanism forward. How practical it is? That's something to be TBD, because again, you're probably, as you have written several code myself, and I'm sure you have done it too in your professional life, when you're going through the thought process of trying to solve a problem, you're not really thinking about securing that solution. The first thing is, can I build a solution that solves my use case? In that process, you're writing code, you're scratching code, you're writing code, scratching code. If I'm writing code and a scan just starts running, it's not fully formed, even to your satisfaction in terms of solving the use case. So I'm not sure how practical that is, although I do see the usefulness of it in terms of reducing the feedback time.
Let's go back to the education piece. Developers find themselves constantly having to learn new languages. They're having to adapt to new architectures, particularly with cloud and IoT and the emphasis on mobile at the moment. How do we find time in that to add security training? Or do we have to go back to how we basically teach developing and reinvent that education?
It's very important to try not to separate really these two worlds, development and security, because there is no conflict there and they're not fighting with each other. They're working on the products or solution together. This separation is the first thing we have to get rid of our minds. And once we've done that, we have to understand that probably both parties have to learn a bit from each other. So developers have to learn a bit about security to make their life easier. And, well, security guys should know a bit more about how these days software development is done. Because, yes, we were talking about the automated testing, and also following that probably will be manual assessment of code and more in-depth analysis, let's say, which might lead to further discoveries. Probably the good thing would be if developers by themselves, they can reach some sort of security baseline based on their technical knowledge, including security. So security will not be a separate entity. It will be embedded in all stages of development of the solution, from the architecture, from the ground zero, literally. Just follows all steps one after another. They will understand better the implications of having those flaws, or just ignoring, or simply not thinking about those implications. It will reduce their time and unnecessary iterations with rewriting and fixing and rewriting code again. Also makes life much easier for security team, because they would focus, they can focus on more advanced problems. In the end, it might work really well if we are talking about just having the job done, having the solution written properly and tested properly.
We often blame developers for everything that goes wrong when it comes to security and code. Part of the problem, however, is this can be down to the libraries. We see vulnerabilities that we thought we patched 5 years, 10 years, 15 years ago, continually in the top 10. SQL injection attacks. Why are we still getting SQL injection attacks? A lot of it's because there's a library they use, there's a set of routines that they use. How do we help them, and how do we make it seamless in terms of the constant scanning and the picking up of these errors in our basic tool sets?
I can give you a very nice example of that, and I can tell you at the beginning that actually I'm a former developer, and I'm really, after all those years in IT, I'm really far from blaming developers for everything. Example I want to give, that I was once engaged in the process of testing software for one small software development company in the UK, really located in some god-forgotten place in some little village in whatever Shropshire. I don't remember really where it was. It was the only building, small office. Everything around was agricultural machinery and seeds selling. Really small company. They were making some CRMs or CMS systems, something like that. Apparently, they made it with many flaws and customers were being hacked. So a couple of customers just sat together and said, right, let's sue those guys. And they sued quite successfully. So that company was asking some help. They came to us, to my former company. And I visited them and I met the team. And I can tell you, it was really bright young people, but they were located there, not in London, not in any place where they might be in the mainstream of all this information. So they did as much as they could. It was the decision of managers to offshore it to that location, have it get cheaper development, but they had to face the implications of that. So if you're asking whom to blame, I would probably blame the manager in this case. And I'm very serious about that, because if you use this business model, you have to understand what side effect of this could be. It's your duty to employ a third-party pen testing company, at least to test the code on a regular basis, to have it sorted if you don't have in-house experts in this area. Yes, you have to control the whole process and understand that it must be done. You can't avoid it. If you want to save money here, just don't be afraid, really, to spend it a bit later there. But it's a must. Otherwise, it will fight back and fight really, really bad.
I'm going to actually try and contradict Alex on this one, because I don't really see that whole thing as a blame game. As I said in the beginning itself, no one wants to write a bad code. Alex touched on it a little bit. It was really not the problem with the developers. They did the best that they knew. And managers did the best. What managers are hired for was to do the development in a cost-effective manner. What lacked in both scenarios is the lack of education and the implication of security, both in the management layer and in the development layer. The third thing that also lacked was quick feedback before the software got shipped, or even when it was getting built. If these two things, the education and the constant feedback, either through better tooling or for security knowledge, was there, then the end outcome would have been different. So I don't really know if it's really a blame game. It's more situational. Being a developer myself for quite a number of years, and so is Alex, when you're developing something, your primary focus is to build something to solve the use case. Can we do it securely? You can do it securely if writing a secure code is a second nature. That second nature does not come from get-go. That second nature comes from consistent training, consistent feedback, and development and redevelopment. To do anything right, it takes several iterations. Can we solve DevSecOps overnight? It's not going to happen overnight. With all this automation and everything, we are getting a step closer every time. But it's going to take its iteration. So when we talk about that there is a friction between dev and SecOps, yes, there was, because both were trying to come in each other's way of developing code or of operations, how it worked both on sec side and op side. It's going to take some time for them to get over that with the right tooling and with the right automation and education. It can be solved. It will take time.
It's interesting to watch the evolution of the blame game and people realizing how destructive it's been. A user accidentally clicks on a link. First thing that happens is everybody blames that user for a security incident. And that funnels all the way down to everybody in operations, in development, even in security who make mistakes. Removing that absolutely takes us a place forward, because oddly enough, that brings us back to one of the basic things of DevOps, doesn't it? It's not about who did what wrong. It's, okay, how do we learn from this? And it's getting that learning.
And you hit the nail in the head with that phishing example. If you go with that example, the first thing that any company that is in the business of educating people, they would say, educate your users, because you could have the best security systems around the globe, but if you do not have the trained users to look at that phishing email and figure out that it is phishing, they would keep clicking on it. You have two choices, either not to allow any communication to happen or train your users so that they know what's a legitimate communication versus the phishing one.
So when we come to that training bit, and I said this is a training for everybody, we're not talking about any one group of individuals here. How do we begin to build those programs out of what we see in our organization? Because many times we import a program from outside for training, and we assume that one size fits all. We can run everybody through this half-day, one-day training program, irrespective of who they are, and they're all going to understand what the risk is. And that's never going to be the case.
I would like to answer this question also coming back to my story. Obviously, I was just winking a bit, saying that we want to blame management. But the thing is, that problem I want to highlight is that we have managers who are very good in finding how to have cheap software development, but not how to make it secure software development. And this definitely requires education. So now coming back to your question. So yes, there should be different and very different trainings for decision makers, for management, and a completely different one for technical personnel. Decision makers must understand implications of not having security at all or having weak security. Because again, this might affect badly their finances, they can be sued, they can have very, very serious problems. In the end, it obviously will ruin their business model as they see that. Completely separate type, different type of courses or education should be prepared for technical personnel, for developers. So they should know more easy to use examples like secure design patterns and many things that they could immediately literally copy paste. And all this is like example side to side. Like this is good example. This is how you should code and this is how you should not. Maybe it should be shorter course for decision makers and maybe longer, maybe a couple of days. Maybe something should be tailored to specific programming language they use.
And I'll go back to something that you have touched upon earlier, is having those libraries. Actually, it helps if you are going to have authentication scheme in every application that you build. Having a library that have built a secure way of authentication could be reused over and over. So you are already reducing some of the issues that you could have by someone not knowing how to code a better authentication module. Having those libraries and utilizing those libraries which are vetted and are going through constant updates, as security is an evolving thing, those are always a good thing. This whole move toward containerization is also going to be another foot forward in that realm.
How does low-code, no-code improve this? Because, first of all, we're taking all these pieces of code. We are hopefully making sure they're all secure. We're running them through tests and we're saying these are approved objects. And then we're allowing people to connect them together. But one of the challenges of connecting things together is we'll never know how every single combination of those objects connected together will be safe or not safe.
The first time someone tried to fly, they had a wings attached with vax, and then they figured out at an altitude when the temperature goes high that those vax really melt. So that was not an idea. So similarly, you'll have challenges just like with any technologies, a new technology that will come out, new modules that will come out. There will be some learning curve. But once you get off that learning curve, now there's planes and rockets flying higher than they ever did. As long as there is an intention to move in that direction after stumbles and falls, we will figure it out. There are a lot of complex problems that as humans we've solved. I'm sure we could solve this too.
I just want to add one thing here. So I think we should not really expect that developers will write completely secure, fully 100% secure code, because it would probably never happen. But it's very realistic that they can reach certain level where it will be secure enough. This should be our goal in this whole story. Then it would still need to be checked by professionals. Why is that? Because even if we have like secure component A and secure component B and secure component C, all three used together might lead to some completely innovative security flaw. And this could be discovered only by trained eyes. I'm not saying nothing new, because we have many stories where we have relatively secure framework, but accidentally people are finding many, many security flaws there. The best option for now would be just to reach this baseline, as I said, having properly trained personnel, properly trained developers, and then leave it to professionals to find more advanced, more interesting holes.
One of our challenges today is that software is not just inside our organization. We don't just write for ourselves, we write for our integration with our channel. One of the problems that we see with security software is often there isn't a platform that's wide enough for me to understand and assess that software coming in from my channel. It might be supply chain, it might be a business partner, it might be a whole range of other people coming in. How do we establish those platforms that are capable of doing that assessment, doing that scanning of that third-party software, and put it in place where it becomes part of our general process?
It's going with the example of, yes, the supply chain security. We talk about that all the time. Either it's for hardware or if it's for software. Similarly, you are using third-party libraries. You are connecting APIs from your partners, which are going to now integratedly work with your solution. How do you ensure that those are secure? I've seen some of the companies that we have consulted with take a proactive approach rather than relying on the customer or the partner itself to take the proactive measures of like, hey, they might write only a secure code. What they do is before integration, they run the same checks that they would do in that written code. So that way, at least at the time, you're creating that baseline that Alex is talking about. There are 0 days. There are always going to be 0 days because, again, security is what you know today. Someone's going to know more tomorrow. For that more tomorrows, that's what we are in business, because it's always an evolving thing. But creating a baseline, either you're connecting a third-party software into your integration or APIs, have that baseline check done automated or manual on anything that integrates with you. I've seen that to work. Always take an approach of cautiousness with everything, mistrust with anything that is coming into your environment, because it's rather to be safe than sorry.
I think it comes down to controls, visibility, and baseline. Thank you both for talking to us today.
Thanks a lot, Ian, for your time as well. It was great speaking with you.
Thank you.